debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. There are a couple of topics that I want to bring up. And the first one, I'll just lay right out there. This young woman who went to Syria to marry an ISIS fighter. Her father is a naturalized U.S. citizen. He's a former diplomat for Yemen. And she is a U.S. citizen. She was born in the United States. She's now 24 years old. She's got an 18-month-old son. And she and her son would like to come back to the United States. And she is saying right up front, she accepts that she will be charged with providing material support to terrorism. She realizes that that might mean that she's going to spend a lot of years in prison. And she is willing to do that. She also says that she was brainwashed and going into Syria and partly motivated by, quote, youthful arrogance. And she has said that she wants to come back to America to help de-radicalize other Americans. And Donald Trump has said no. He has instructed Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, to say that this woman no longer is a U.S. citizen, even though she was born here, even though her father is a naturalized U.S. citizen, that she's no longer a citizen, and that, you know, case closed. And this is that, you know, kind of brutal justice on the one hand. On the other hand, we don't know that she did anything other than marry fighters. She married two fighters. They both died. Maybe she married a third. She married guys who were ISIS fighters. But whether she was doing anything, you know, probably not. But we don't know. But she did, you know, go to a foreign country. ISIS had proclaimed itself a country, and they had a physical land. This isn't like Al-Qaeda. And, you know, embraced what they were up to, apparently. So I was looking, doing some research this morning about, you know, what is it that can cause you to lose your citizenship? Because, you know, do Trump and Pompeo have a legal basis here? And it turns out that there are basically seven things that you can do to cause yourself to lose citizenship. You can become a naturalized citizen of another country. These all are after age 18, right? These are all as adults. Become a naturalized citizen of another country. You can lose your citizenship. Formally declare allegiance to a foreign government. Lose your citizenship. Accept a position in a foreign country that requires you to declare allegiance to that country. Lose your citizenship. Join the military force of another country that is engaged in hostilities against the U.S. Lose your citizenship. Formally renounce your U.S. nationality abroad in front of a U.S. diplomat or a consular officer. You can formally renounce your U.S. nationality in the U.S. when the U.S. is at war, in writing and with the approval of the Justice Department, and lose your citizenship. And lose your citizenship if you've been convicted of treason or attempting to overthrow the U.S. government. which raises a couple of interesting questions. But let me give you the caveat to these. The first is that the act, those seven things, if you do any one of those seven things, it must be done with the specific intent to relinquish your U.S. citizenship. And as far as I can tell, and of course, this story, there's a long way to go in this story. This is very early on. But I have not seen anything or heard anything from her that would indicate that she intended to renounce her U.S. citizenship. It was just, you know, hey, you know, she fell in love with this guy online and flew to Syria to marry him and thought ISIS was cool. She got brainwashed, she says. So number one. And number two, and this is particularly fascinating. This is over at NOLO.com. Legal encyclopedia. It is not enough to appear to commit the act, even voluntarily, to lose your U.S. nationality. The person must also commit the act in order to relinquish their nationality. So it's not enough to just join a foreign fighting force and fight against the United States to lose your nationality. You have to do that in order to lose your nationality. It has to be your intention. And, you know, I just find this fascinating. This says to me, if you know, assuming that all of the legality, the legal stuff, I've gone through four or five different legal websites this morning looking this up. Eamon Kassou's summary seems to be the tightest. But they all say basically the same thing. And I don't see any evidence that Hoda Muthanna actually did this with the intention of renouncing her U.S. citizenship. And now she is trying to claim her U.S. citizenship. So my question to you, should she be allowed back into the United States? And should she be allowed to retain her U.S. citizenship? But I think that the second question that all of this raises, since Trump is so quick to strip this woman of her citizenship, is that, you know, he's saying that she engaged in at least a couple of those seven things that I read to you. Now, the law says you have to do it with the intention of renouncing your citizenship. And I've seen no evidence that she did that. But if Trump and Pompeo, who is our Secretary of State, if they're going to change the rules, and frankly, I don't think they can, but if they're going to change the rules to say all you have to do is one of these seven things, and one of those seven things is participating in an attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, then why is Tim McVeigh still a U.S. citizen? Why are they not doing citizenship proceedings against the guy who was arrested at the Coast Guard base in Washington, D.C., who was putting together, you know, an arsenal to try to start a civil war? I mean, how is that not an attempt to overthrow the U.S. government? Tim McVeigh thought he was going to start a civil war, a racially based civil war. So if we're adopting Trump's new strategy of saying, well, you know, if you did one of these seven things, if you attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, but if you're doing any of these things, you're no longer a citizen. How far do we take this? Where does this all go? So anyhow, that's the, I've got a couple of questions that I want to toss out to you today. Boy, this story, I just want to recap it very quickly. This mother came to the United States from Guatemala, where she had been raped by a member of the Guatemalan military that was, quote, protecting the town she lived in. She was one of a number of women in this town who were routinely being raped by these soldiers. She fled to the United States with her three-year-old child, her daughter. She reached the U.S. border and went to an official border entry point, a legal crossing point, as our law specifies a person is supposed to do if they're seeking asylum, and as international law says, but U.S. law says this. She applied for asylum there. Her application was accepted, and then they took her child away from her, and for 8.5 weeks refused to tell her where her daughter was. She later learned that her daughter had been taken to a place called the Hacienda del Sol. It was shut down because the staffers were routinely engaging in child abuse, actually abusing the children. During that period of time, about 8 weeks into this, she was allowed a phone call with her daughter. She literally every day she had been begging, "Where is my daughter?" And finally, after 8 weeks, they gave her a phone call. And when her daughter started crying 2 minutes into the call, the social worker cut the line. That was it. 2 weeks later, she was reunited with her daughter through the efforts of some good lawyers. And, you know, her asylum claim is being processed. This was all done illegally, essentially, by the Trump administration. You know, tearing children from their parents. That's not part of the law. before Trump, the only time in history that that has ever been done is when, for example, during the Obama administration, when they thought that the person who was representing themselves as a parent was not actually the parent, that they might be trafficking the child or that they were explicitly abusive. This little girl now, when she's asked questions, gives one-word answers. She's afraid to go outside. She cannot go outside with her mother. She starts screaming and shrieking. She cannot fall asleep unless her mother is holding her, not just in the same room, holding her. The minute mom lets go, this little girl wakes up and starts screaming. This is what your tax dollars are paying for. This is what Donald Trump is so proud of. On the line with us is Julio Rivera, the editorial director at Reactionary Times, columnist at Newsmax, an American thinker, and townhall.com, reactionarytimes.com. His Twitter handle, oh yeah, it's Julio. Julio, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
So, in my opinion, Donald Trump and Mike Pence, and perhaps Kristen Nielsen, the head of DHS, should be arrested and prosecuted for kidnapping and child abuse. What say you?
Okay, first off, to this little narrative framing that you're doing, Tom, trying to make it seem like this is a
This is
phenomenon.
One of probably 3,000 stories, Julio.
This goes back to every president, vice president, and the administration from Bill Clinton in 1997 on.
No,
this is
no, Julio, I'm sorry. I can't let you just lie on the air like that. Julio, that is not true. Look it up.
It is. Florida's consent decree, which went ahead and allowed for, I think you have, listen, I'm not going to deny.
The only reason legally the children could be separated from their parents was if there was a suspicion of abuse or human trafficking. Donald Trump changed that, and John Kelly went on national television and said, the reason we're changing this policy, the reason we're tormenting these children, is to discourage parents from showing up at our border with kids.
Well, you know what? That's not the worst idea in the world. I mean, and I'm not saying that we should be holding the kids accountable and punish the children. That's an unfortunate byproduct of a broken system.
This is not a broken system. This is a crime.
No, what we need to do, and this speaks to the larger problem, we need to build that wall. We need to enforce our immigration laws domestically.
About immigration. This is about refugee status.
At the end of the day, you're pointing out, you know, one story, and it is an unfortunate story, but when you have thousands, literally thousands of children, there's no way that, you know, we don't have the infrastructure to support bringing in all these illegals.
That's why you leave them with their parents, Julio.
Unfortunately.
That's why you leave them with their parents. I mean, you got children's prisons now that are being built.
Because it's not our problem, Tom. That's what you fail to see. You know, if we didn't have our open border policies and sanctuary cities and all these things, we were sanctioning the people who hire these people and create opportunities for them, paying them under the table. And if we hit them so hard that they would have no economic opportunities, they wouldn't come here. And guess what, Tom? Then it wouldn't be our problem.
That's an immigration argument, and thank you for echoing my point. But this, I'm not talking about immigration here. We have had negative immigration from the United States over the last 10 years with regard to Mexico. Actually, the majority of people who are overstaying their visas, who are coming into this country legally and ending up being here illegally and in many cases working, are Canadians. The majority, not Mexicans, Canadians. Mexicans have been leaving this country and going back to Mexico. But what this is, well, let me just finish this sentence and then you can react. What this is refugees. Ronald Reagan committed treason by conspiring with Iran to sell them weapons in exchange for their holding hostages to make Jimmy Carter look like a fool to win an election. After that happened, he took that money and he used it to buy weapons to support right-wing governments down in Central America, in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Elliot Abrams was right in the middle of this war criminal Elliot Abrams, who Bob Barr, the guy that was just made Attorney General, recommended George Herbert Walker Bush pardon, which he did. And that ruined those countries. Those countries are absolute messes now because of U.S. policy, and their people are coming here as refugees.
Well, listen, Tom, that's another debate. But the whole thing as far as refugees seeking asylum, there's a lot of people that are coming in right now making that claim that are not truly refugees. So we have to really take a deep look into each one of their cases.
I agree. That's why we need more judges. That's why we need more officers investigating these situations. You know, there should be due process. If somebody comes, you know, with their child and says, I'm a refugee, the police were raping me, my child was threatened, there should be due process. Trump has dialed back on that. He has not spent the $1 billion that Congress appropriated 2 years ago for this kind of thing. He has not spent that money. He has dialed back on that, and instead he's saying he wants his trophy wall.
It's not a trophy wall. The wall would prevent all these problems going forward.
This and woman did not illegally cross a border, Julio. She presented herself at a port of entry in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. You're using this one case. But this
the
is
vast majority of these children who have been separated came to legal ports of entry.
I understand, but not all of them. The bigger problem is that right now we have to go ahead and say, and you're right, listen, these refugee cases, yes, we need more judges. We need more people looking at these. There's some people that have suffered some horrific atrocities at the hands of some shady government and, you know, illegal, you know, crime, organized crime figures within their country. And it's horrible. The human trafficking, all of it has to end. But the best path to do that is to go ahead and say, you know, put up that wall and say, listen, America is closed. For right now, it's closed. And if you come into a legal port of entry, yes, then we'll go ahead and review your asylum application.
And steal
and
your child?
A legitimate claim, you'll get it.
But, and steal your child?
We have too much. We have too much
and
going on.
And steal your
right
child?
What was that?
And steal your child?
Not steal your child. If we
so you're agreeing with me that Donald Trump and Mike Pence should be in jail for child abuse and kidnapping.
And we hold the children for no longer than 20 days, which we have the legal right to keep the parents separated from the children for up to 20 days, I believe, under the Flores consent decree, while these things are going on.
That was only in cases where you suspect child trafficking, Julio, number one. And number two, even one day of separation for a three-year-old can destroy the rest of their lives.
Well, that's debatable, but yes, it is horrible. It's horrible. But I don't think that you can put that on the Trump administration. The way that you're trying to frame this is that, oh, we're going to...
John Kelly came out and bragged about this. Kristen Nielsen testified before Congress. This is a deterrence policy. This is a brand new thing in the history of the United States. We are going to tear families apart and put children in children's prisons where they're not allowed to be touched. Their parents can't talk to them.
I have a question for you, Tom. When this caravan was coming up, and let me finish this before you cut me off. When this caravan was coming up, and a lot of people were saying that they wanted asylum from whatever Central American country they were coming from, Mexico offered them asylum, and they didn't take it. So at the end of the day, some of the personal responsibility has to fall on the parents as well.
About three quarters of the people who came up in the last so-called caravan, this group of a little over 1,000 people who came up through Mexico that Donald Trump was hysterical about. Let's say it was 2,000, just before the election. Okay, let's say it was 10,000. Mm-hmm. More than 70% of them stayed in Mexico. They have not come to the U.S. border.
Mm-hmm. Well, they should have all stayed in Mexico.
Well, you know, I mean, that day may come, but this is a mess that we created. That war criminal Elliot Abrams and the war criminals Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. put this thing together. And now you've got Mike Pence and Donald Trump, and I think these guys should be arrested for kidnapping and child abuse.
How are left-wing governments doing in South America right now? How's Venezuela working out for you? How's democratic socialism working?
Julio, I am not a Venezuelan. I'm an American, and I'm concerned about what is being done in my country, and I'm concerned about the fact that Mike Pence and Donald Trump are engaging in kidnapping and child abuse and proud of it, and they've got people defending them for that.
Listen, there's going to be unfortunate cases like the case that you keep referencing. That's like, I'm sure that that's like the needle in the haystack. That's not the majority across the board.
So you think the vast majority of children who are torn apart from their parents for months at a time are just fine with it?
Sure, that these kids are not being trafficked in for child abuse, for sexual abuse, for all the horrible things, the atrocities that these poor people face. We have to make sure that at the very least, the one thing we can guarantee them with while they were in U.S. custody was that child was not being raped.
Well, no, we can't guarantee them that because that's why they shut down the center where this woman's child was taken, because they were abusing the children.
They were not abusing the children.
They absolutely were. It was shut down. Look it up. It's called Hacienda del Sol in Arizona. You can Google it. Anyhow, Julio Rivera, ReactionaryTimes.com, his Twitter handle. Oh, yeah, it's Julio. Hang on just a second, Julio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Julio, thanks for coming on and talking with me. I appreciate it.
I always love coming on. Have a great day, Tom.
Thanks, you too, Julio. Bye-bye. Everyone's talking about the decline in stock values over the last few months. If you've been listening to Lynette Zhang's YouTube show, you probably aren't surprised by the fall. Her fact-based research on markets, currencies, and economics is second to none. And her presentations have pointed to most every major downfall we've recently seen in the U.S. economy. Her video titled Just Before the Crash showed people the exact patterns to look out for and now has over 210,000 views and counting. Lynette Zhang has been on my show and works with my friends at ITM Trading. I highly recommend looking them up as they are pioneers in creating wealth protection strategies with gold and silver. If you're a strategic investor looking to protect your wealth or just hedge against the most volatile markets since 2007, then call my friends at ITM Trading at 1-888-OWN-GOLD. Ask for their free gold protection guide and join the top 1% who are now accumulating very specific types, dates, and qualities of physical gold and silver. Call 1-888-OWN-GOLD. That's 1-888-OWN-GOLD. Alex in Edison, New Jersey. Hey, Alex, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching us on YouTube.
Hi, Tom. It's immigration. So one word that's not in the debate or phrase, permanent damage. That is what we're doing to these children.
Yes. And I would argue to their parents as well, although the children are much more vulnerable.
But there's a big picture aspect, too. How, you know, when our trade negotiators talk to China or, better yet, Europe, this stuff comes into play. Our reputation is being hurt, and I don't know what's worse. I mean, there's different, it's hard to measure one or the other to compare, but I don't really care to, you know, this impacts my patriotism, knowing that my tax dollars go to inflict permanent damage. The government has psychologists, they know that, but they don't care. Well, at least one party. Anyway, that's your comments, and I'll take it off.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. Alex, thank you very much. I get how heartfelt you are about this, and I share it. And in terms of patriotism and in terms of our ability to negotiate with other people, this, I believe, is one of the major reasons why when Mike Pence was in Europe and he said, I bring you greetings from President Donald Trump, and then he waited for the applause, literally not one person clapped. And Ivanka Trump was in the audience. She didn't even clap. Although I think that's because she was shocked. Angel in San Gabriel, California. What's up, Angel?
Hey, Tom. Good morning. I have two comments to make. One is the immigration problem. It's easy to fix. Just our president, I don't think he really wants to do it. The first thing he has to do is the good people who are not criminals, they should get a work permit. Otherwise, if he deports everybody, the whole country is going to collapse. Now, after that, he needs to find the companies who hire the people with no papers. The first time, the second time, put them out of business.
I agree.
Then when we need more visas, then send more visas to all the countries so people come to work legally. That's the thing.
Yeah, Trump had hired, Trump had like 15 people working for him in Bedminster at his golf club for, in some cases, as much as 18 years, knowing that they were not in this country legally. And Trump is the guy who is, you know, screaming about this stuff. If you want to start putting rich white employers who are hiring people undocumented in this country, and again, that's a separate issue from asylum seekers, but if you want to do that, let's start by putting either Donald Trump or the people who made the decisions, probably his son or his daughter or somebody or whoever's running his golf club, put them in jail. Amen. Angel, thank you for the call. Lee in Beverly Hills, listening on KPFK. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Oh, hello. On the wall, I have noticed that Trump positively adores dictators, and that is obviously because he is one of them, the dictator in chief, who happens to be occupying the White House.
Yep.
And it is dreadfully unfortunate, but in the United States of America, I don't think he would be able to get away with building one of those humongous statues, such as in North Korea and throughout many other parts of the world in the previous Soviet Union. And therefore, it appears to me his substitute is this wall with plaques of him and his name all over it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is his substitute for the adulation that he absolutely wants from his followers. And he seems to be almost psychotically addicted to getting people to have undying, unflinching, unconscious loyalty to him.
Yeah.
And if they do not, then he plays his reality TV show and fires them. You're fired.
And then tries to destroy them and their families and everybody around them. Lee, what you just said was profound, and it gave me this huge aha that, you know, yes, you know, Stalin had statues to Stalin all over the country. Mao had statues to Mao all over the country. Kim Jong-un has statues to Kim all over the country. And Trump can't quite do that here in the United States. I mean, that's what the Reagan Legacy Project did, build a statue to Ronald Reagan in every single congressional district in the United States. But that was after Reagan, you know, was no longer president. And Reagan didn't do that. The billionaires who funded him did that. So Trump can't build statues to himself, and he can't wait. In fact, he may not live long enough to see the statues, just like Ronald Reagan didn't live long enough to see all the statues being built to himself. So the statue he's trying to build to himself right now is this wall. That is profound. Lee, thank you so much for that. Thanks for the call, and thanks for your kind words. Thank you for listening to KPFK. And welcome back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world. Today's report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, the new book by Ellen Ratner. And on the line with us is the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, joining us from UN headquarters in New York City, Luke Vargas. You can hear Luke present one world news story in 2 minutes every day by searching Luke Vargas wherever you get your podcasts. So, Luke, Venezuela, I saw in the news just before I went on the air that Maduro government had actually opened fire on people on the, I believe it was the Brazilian-Venezuelan border, and killed somebody. What's going on down there?
Well, let's just bear in mind, Venezuela has, I believe, close to 1,000 miles of borders, and all of them are sort of, you might see infiltration by activists or others who are trying to move aid in either today or over the next 24 hours or so. I mean, tomorrow is the day that the Venezuelan opposition has said they are going to order foreign aid to be allowed to come in through any of the border crossings. The Maduro government is saying absolutely not. As of, I guess it was 5 p.m. last night, they closed down borders with Brazil, the crossings, and the clash that we were just mentioning occurred this morning. Either one or two people are dead. We're getting a little conflicting reports, but there is a indigenous tribe called the Pemon, which are in this area of sort of the upper Amazon, and they had apparently reached a deal with Guaido, the opposition leader in Venezuela, to help, you know, knowing knowledge of the area very well, to allow, you know, to sort of smuggle aid in on behalf of the opposition. We have been sort of preparing to see some sort of clash in this respect on rivers. I mean, this is kind of how crazy and big this story is. Mm. You know, you had an indigenous tribe going to be using canoes on rivers in the middle of the Amazon to take aid into the country. And that was something I was going to watch for on Saturday. Here we see this group, evidently members of it, lying down in front of military vans this morning to try and block the closure of the border, and troops opened fire on them, and one or two people have been killed. I mean, suffice it to say, we're still a day away from the main event here, and here's an area where maybe we weren't counting on seeing violence, and we're already seeing it, which means it's almost hard to predict.
Very quick one here, Luke. We just have 20 seconds or so.
Yep.
North Korea says they're suffering a food shortage. Is this handing Donald Trump a bargaining chip?
It's either telling the Chinese that they should import more, you know, send more food and weaken the U.S. arguments against doing that, or it's trying to give a reason to hold a summit when it doesn't look like there's a good reason for it. I mean, the last thing we've been told is the point of this summit is to determine if they're serious about denuclearization. That was supposed to have already been sorted out, so maybe here is the rationale. If there's no other reason to talk, do it for humanitarian purposes.
Or trade food for denuclearization.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's all on the table. We don't know what's on the table.
There you go. Okay, Luke Vargas. Luke, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tom Hartman here with you, and on the line with me is Mark Guthel. He is the Kane County Democratic Chairman, Kane Dems. Kane County is near, just outside Chicago in Illinois. Kane Dems, KaneDems.org is the website. You can tweet him at Kane Dems. And Mark, I'm pronouncing your name right, aren't I?
It's pronounced Gately.
Gately, I'm sorry.
But close enough.
No, let's do it right. Mark Gately. My apologies. So tell me about the Truman Dinner. I know it's sold out, so this isn't, you know, just a kind of a naked plug for trying to, you know, do a fundraiser or anything here. But this is the kind of thing that really active, really good Democratic Party groups do. We heard earlier from a guy in South Carolina, I think it was, or North Carolina, and he showed up at his local Democratic Party, and there were only four people, and they were all like over 70, and they were all totally dispirited. And he's like, no, we need to make things happen. And they're like, oh, we don't have, you know. And you guys are the absolute contrast to that. Tell us about the Kane County Democratic Party.
So the Kane County Democratic Party is about an hour outside of the city of Chicago. We have 500,000 people who reside in Kane County. We've been winning elections incrementally since 2002. Recently, we just picked up the two congressional seats, which would be Lauren Underwood and Sean Casten, which are very important for us, for everything that we stand for. The event is our annual fundraiser that we host every year to raise money for our candidates throughout the smaller races like county board and so forth. And we've been successful there as well. So it's a big event for us. Thank you for having me on your show. And thank you so much for coming out and being our keynote speaker.
We're talking with Mark Gately. He's the Kane County Democratic Chairman. I have said for years on this program that the most powerful political position in the United States is not the president. It's a precinct committee chair or a precinct committee person, because these are the people who, and in some states it's a paid job, in most states it's a volunteer job, and in some states there are not even people showing up for it. And these are the folks who are selecting the primary candidates or helping select the primary candidates. These are the folks who are helping write the platform. This is where it all starts. Can you reality check me on that? Is that an accurate statement?
You're going in the right direction, but a precinct committee person is like more local. So in the state of Illinois, we're governed by county parties. So we have Kane County Democrats, DuPage County Democrats. Mm-hmm. But under that umbrella, for us, are the committee people. So then we're broken up in 16 townships. In each township, they elect their own chairperson. And they're selected by the precinct committee person. Ultimately, you want to run for precinct committee person because then you elect the officers such as myself and our executive board.
Right.
More importantly, they're the ones who get out to vote for the Democrats. They go knocking on doors, they canvass, they phone bank, they identify our supporters, your registered voters. It's really important. And we're all volunteers, so I get it when people call the office and they don't get a call right back, but we're all volunteers here. Be patient. We're all on the same team. We want to go in the same direction. We just need to understand is be patient with everybody in different, you know, towns and townships and states, because it's really important.
Yeah, and if you live in
a good precinct committee.
If you live in Kane County, go to KaneDems.org. Check it out. Toss in your hat. I mean, participate. Get out there. Get active.
Yes.
Tag. You're it, right? Are you noticing more enthusiasm than in previous years? I know that the last couple of elections have actually it's been real interesting how things have changed politically in the United States, particularly since 9/11. What's the state of the Democratic Party, both locally and nationally, from your point of view as the chairman of the Kane County Democrats?
Okay, we'll start with our state party. It's Illinois is pretty solid blue, and then the collar counties outside of the city were blue. So, like, the elections are decided by voters, and voters were the populace is. And I don't mean to say anything about the rest of the state, but the large portion of the votes come from the city and outside the city into the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're very active. We're active throughout the state. It's just that from the area that I'm at, I think Trump lost Kane County by like 16 points.
Wow. You guys are doing your job.
And Lauren won her race against the incumbent Republican by 6 points, and she carried Kane by like 7 points. So she outperformed, then she overperformed because it was an R plus four. But she was just a great candidate and everything lined up, and we have a lot of young people coming into the party that are participating. We embrace everybody that wants to get out and help us, you know, canvas and phone bank.
So if somebody calls, if they go to your website, KaneDems.org, and I'm assuming that we can generalize this across pretty much any county Democratic Party in the United States. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, too. Somebody goes to Kane Dems, they get your phone number, they get your email address, or they whatever, they drop in. They come to a meeting. What's your advice to people about to say what to do, how to come in, how to be part of, you know, what's you know, kind of etiquette?
Yeah, just attend the meeting, listen, be patient. People are there. They want you, they want to work with you, but sometimes it's hard to get a hold of the party or the township. But be patient. They're there, and they want you. They need your help. We're rolling, man. We're on the move.
There you go. Mark Gately, he is the chairman of the Kane County Democratic Party. Kane Dems, K-A-N-E, Dems.org is the website. You can tweet him at Kane Dems, K-A-N-E-D-E-M-S. Mark, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Thank you very much.
My friends at X-Chair are at it again, constantly tinkering to make an already superior product even better so you can work in even more comfort and be that much more productive. Now you can enhance your X-Chair's performance and protect your floors with incredible X-Wheel blade casters. These urethane wheels are driven by butter-smooth, whisper-quiet ball bearings and are built to last. As if the X-Chair isn't comfortable enough, now you can add a set of X-Wheels and take your performance to the next level. Take advantage of X-Chair's new financing option and pay as little as $30 a month. Seriously, for less than the cost of a daily cup of coffee, you can take your comfort and productivity into the stratosphere by getting yourself an X-Chair. X-Chair is on sale now for $100 off. Just go to xchairtom.com now. That's xchairtom.com or call 1-844-4XCHAIR. X-Chair comes with a 30-day no questions asked guarantee of complete satisfaction. Go to xchairtom.com now and use the code TOM for a free footrest. That's xchairtom.com. xchairtom.com. We are, for this next half hour, going to get into one of our conversations with great minds. I'm so glad to have with us Dr. Douglas Rushkoff. He's the founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism and a professor of media theory and digital economics at City University, New York, Queen's Research Fellow, Institute for the Future, author of more than 20 books, including his latest just released, Team Human: Our Technologies, Markets, and Cultural Institutions, Once Forces for Human Connection and Expression, Now Isolate and Repress Us. It's time to remake society together, not as individual players, but as the team we actually are. Last time we talked with Douglas was about your book, Present Shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the last time, yeah.
And some time ago.
Yeah, and that was 2013.
2013,
did one between then and now called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus.
Which sounds like a great book.
Yeah, all the sort of the inequality of the digital economy, and now Team Human.
To start with Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, these were the buses that Google uses in Silicon Valley to transport their workers around?
Yeah, I mean, the whole book wasn't about that, but it kind of served as a starting point that, you know, here's a company that was too... kids from Stanford, we're going to take down big bad corporate Yahoo by creating a people's algorithm that would let us search the net in a new way from the bottom up. You know, they took too much money and ended up being this really awful extractive behemoth that needs to grow. And people who lived in San Francisco, where the company's operating, you know, watch their real estate prices and their rents go way, way up, you know, to the point where the city's unlivable for them. And the employees who live there, and there was sort of a nice idea that Google thought, instead of having them drive back and forth, we'll create these big air-conditioned Wi-Fi buses that'll transport them back, you know, to and from the mothership. Right. But to people in San Francisco, it felt like sort of a symbol of the alien invasion of, here are these people that are using San Francisco as a backdrop and a bedroom community, making it unlivable for real people, while all the capital, all the resources is being sucked out by this big company down in Mountain View. And, you know, it wasn't just that the prices, real estate prices or rents tripled and quadrupled, but if you were in walking distance of one of the Google bus stops, your rent was another 30% higher than it was elsewhere. So people started laying down in front of the buses and saying, you know, gentrification. And then in Oakland, someone actually threw a rock at one of the Google buses, and a minor riot happened. And people were tweeting at me saying, oh, Doug, aren't you going to cheer on what happened? Like, I can't cheer that on because...
It's violence.
And I got friends on that bus, you know, who are just trying to make a living and earn however much they need to earn before they burn out. You know, so I wanted to sort of unwind that and show how we're all responsible for this sort of extractive explosion.
Well, and we see this, I mean, not just in San Francisco with Google. We see this not necessarily with the bus, but this dynamic at work with Amazon in Seattle, Starbucks in Seattle, perhaps.
Uber in London, maybe. Yeah, you know, it depends. It's everywhere. Yeah. And it's because of that big disconnection. These companies are not serving real people or places. What they're doing is serving shareholders. These are all extractive models.
It seems like there's an analogy or an analog between that and, for example, how Walmart moves into a community and destroys, on average, 100 local businesses, and they will target those businesses.
Absolutely. You know, and I wrote about that. What it takes Walmart, say, 10 or 15 years to do in a community, where they go in, they undercut all the local sellers, put everyone out of business, so they become not only the sole retailer, but the sole employer in a community, so then they can underpay people or have them on part-time wages. Then all those people who are working at Walmart are also on food stamps and on welfare, and, you know, in order, and on Medicaid or whatever, to get basic services. So the net effect is a drag. But Walmart's playbook is based on the British East India Company's playbook, the early colonial playbook of extractive capitalism.
Which we rebelled against with the Boston Tea Party.
Right. And folks like Adam Smith, who have become the patron saints of libertarianism, were actually the people arguing about the problem of large capitalism.
Oh, theory of moral sentiments. Right. I mean, he wrote an entire book that was basically, here's the dangers of capitalism. Uh-huh. And the phrase invisible hand only appears once in Wealth of Nations. And
right.
It appears that in that one place, in the context of protective tariffs, essentially. I mean, the sentence begins something like preferring domestic manufacture to that of foreign, you know, bloody, 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 the
exactly.
invisible hand, bloody, blah.
You know, which is really my pivot to this book, to Team Human, was where I was realizing, well, these sort of large abstracted rule sets, you know, that used to be enforced by law in British East India time or Walmart time are now being enforced with code. You know, so we're sort of reifying.
By code, you mean digital
computer
code?
Computer code. That now we're living on digital landscapes that are just as oppressive as, you know, the stock market or industrialism or the economic operating system that we were using. You know, Mark Zuckerberg and people who are building digital companies are really building them on top of an operating system that they're not even acknowledging. They didn't go to school. They drop out of college at 19 before they've taken economics, before they've taken anthropology. So they don't know that there's another operating system embedded in the platforms they're building.
And that operating system is?
Corporate capitalism. It's extractive corporate capitalism.
Right.
How do we use human beings as a profit center for shares?
This is digital colonialism.
It's exactly digital colonialism. And it's why, and it's interesting, it's why even privileged white males now can experience what it's like to be an indigenous population, because at least we're indigenous to the real world, and now we're seeing this sort of algorithmic invasion.
Which is why you're seeing privileged white males voting for Donald Trump when he promises them that he's going to at least give them back the dignity that they had in the 50s, 60s, 70s when they could get a union job without bringing back the unions.
Right, right. And what he is speaking to, and this is sort of what I'm trying to speak to also, and that we all have to speak to, is that it sounds so new agey, but there's an essential dignity to human beings,
yes,
that we are worth more than our utility value. You know, and that, again, it goes back to Marx, and I'm sorry, but, you know, human beings.
Marx's analysis was,
right,
was
spot
solid.
On.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it's that we are more than the inputs and outputs. And the minute that we take on the market's logic as our own, the minute that we only value ourselves in terms of our utility and what we can produce, that's when we've lost.
Yeah. So back in the 1960s, a guy named Robert Bork came up with an idea. Back in the 1880s, 1881, 82, whatever it was, Senator Sherman from Ohio first introduced what came to be the Sherman Antitrust mm-hmm. Act of 1890. And it was vigorously enforced by Teddy Roosevelt and by Taft after him. And the whole idea of this was that bigness, giant corporations getting too large, controlling markets either vertically or horizontally, was a bad thing because it was destructive to communities, which is what you've mm-hmm. just been talking about. It was destructive to what they would refer to as competition, what today we would call entrepreneurism
mm-hmm.
or entrepreneurialism, the ability of small people to start companies to compete with them. It was destructive of families. It was not honoring, in many cases, not even honoring the institutions of the company. They were producing vast, vast differences in inequality and wealth. That these were all the evils of monopoly. And that was widely understood in the United States. In the 60s, Bork came along, wrote a paper about this, and said, no, that's all wrong. What Senator Sherman really was talking about, and what we really need to worry about when we enforce antitrust law, is the prices consumers pay. And the only metric that we should use to decide whether we're going to break a company up or forbid a merger is whether or not it's going to lower prices for consumers. And that became a doctrine that was adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case, I'm forgetting the name, Sullivan is in that name, in the 1970s, I think it was 77, and it became the policy of the Reagan administration, and we have had no antitrust enforcement since then that doesn't specifically deal with nothing but is the consumer still getting a cheap price. So they don't view Walmart as a monopoly, for example, right, even if it may be the only store within 100 miles for a town, because you still have cheap Chinese junk that you can buy at low prices.
And the only metric they're looking at is the price, but not the cost.
That's right. Yeah. So how do we, A, if we've accurately diagnosed at least one small piece of the problem, how do we wake Americans up to that, and how do we change that?
Well, a bunch of ways. I mean, the simplest team human approach would be, how do we help people see themselves as sort of 360-degree human beings rather than just in their roles as consumers? You know, yeah, I'm a consumer sometimes, but I'm a parent, I'm a producer, I'm a worker, I'm all these other things. So if I'm understanding my rights in terms of that customer's always right, and that's the way I express myself, well, then look, then we get an American Idol presidential election, of course.
Which is what we have.
Right, because we've bought into that sensibility. I mean, one cure for that is going to be when people don't have the money to buy stuff anymore. So they're going to have to start looking
around.
Well,
that's what happened in the late 20s, early 30s. You know, and by the way, that's also what happened in 1846 with the Great Depression then that led to the Civil War. It's what happened in 1770 in the Great Panic. 1770 that led to the Tea Party, that led to the American Revolution. I mean, it seems that about every 80 years, and the fourth turning, those guys, I'm forgetting their names right now, Howe and Strauss, wrote about this, about how every 80 years we have this, you know, a collapse followed by a war, followed by a reboot, and typically a major progressive reboot, which I've been kind of hoping for.
Yeah, but that reboot's only going to work if people engage with one another rather than their devices. In other words, as things get worse, are we going to retreat into video games and Twitter and bad TV? You know, are we going to have enough money to do that? Or are we going to decide that other people are more interesting?
Well, isn't this what Robert Draper was writing about in 2001 or 3 or whenever he wrote Bowling Alone?
Right.
If I'm remembering his name.
Yeah, Robert Putnam.
Putnam,
yeah.
That's right.
He was looking at the collapse of civic society's institutions.
Yeah.
You know, everything from the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts to the Elks Club and the Kiwanis.
And asking why. And some of the possible answers were cable TV, people are working too hard, Reaganism has destroyed the middle class, you know, everybody's addicted to their screens. Is there another piece to this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of it. It's really, we are taking a potentially very powerful connecting industry, you know, the internet. I mean, you were around for the beginning when it was going to...
Oh, I ran forums on CompuServe in the
80s. Yeah, exactly. And it was, you know, and we all, I mean, a lot of us believed that it was going to be the realization of the kind of the Gaian mind. You know, this is the way the humans and the planet would connect up each other's nervous systems and get to experience...
Oh, and we had extraordinary community in our CompuServe communities, but you were required to use your real name, which is a whole other thing.
There was a rule you weren't allowed to do commercial activity online either.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Douglas Rushkoff, Dr. Douglas Rushkoff is with us. Team Human is his new book. It's our Conversations with Great Minds.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His website, Rushkoff, RUSHKOFF.com. You can tweet him at Rushkoff. What most people don't realize about working in radio is that it's hungry work. I mean it. And you know, cooking can seem like a chore, but that's where HelloFresh comes in. They take the guesswork out of cooking by offering a wide-ranging menu with classics that we know and love, like the gorgeous greens farro bowl or the delicious grilled sriracha glazed salmon, to recipes you might not be as familiar with, courtesy of their gourmet menu. Get fresh and affordable, high-quality ingredients delivered right to your doorstep, pre-measured. So all you have to do is follow the recipe. It could not be easier. That's what makes HelloFresh America's number one meal kit. For a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first three boxes. Visit HelloFresh.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. That's HelloFresh.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. Get a total of $60 off. That's $20 off your first three boxes. Visit HelloFresh.com/Tom. That's HelloFresh.com/T-H-O-M. HelloFresh.com/Tom. How unique is this in human history? I called him Draper. You said his name was
Putnam.
Putnam, that's right. He was mostly pointing a finger at number one, people were working longer and harder because of the destruction of unions, and number two, television, cable television, if I'm remembering correctly. Now you're talking about the digital forces that are tearing us apart. Is this something that's cyclical?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, it's older. You know, I think that there's some really old and disparaging notions about human beings and our behavior that we're kind of embedding in our digital infrastructure, and they're not really true. So the idea that evolution was a competition between individuals for the survival of the fittest. Read Darwin.
That's not what Darwin said. That's what Herbert Spencer said.
Right. Exactly. It's what Spencer said, or Hayek, or someone else. You know, it's not. You know, evolution is actually the story of how species collaborate and cooperate with one another in order to ensure mutual survival.
To assure homeostasis, basically.
Right.
Environmental stasis.
Right. I was taught in school that the big tree, you know, is getting all the sun and shades the little one, and the little one will perish and the big one will live. Turns out that's not true. The big tree is sharing nutrients with the little tree through a network of mycelia in the soil, right, which turns out to be alive and not just dirt.
Yep.
And then, you know, in the winter, when the big tree loses its leaves, the little one's an evergreen, it returns through the soil matrix some nutrients to the big tree, and the mushrooms take a service fee for it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
So it's like, well, wait a minute, what's that? That's not the story I was told. And then we learn that, you know, if human beings really are the most advanced species, it's really just to the extent that we can collaborate and communicate. So we develop language and text and all these things to allow for higher levels of coordination. But, you know, really, when we take any of these tools, even when we use text, you look at the first use of text, and it was to count slaves. It was to keep track of people's slaves.
Back 7,000 years ago in Samaria.
Yeah, when they were, that's what they used it for. You know, you look at the printing press. You know, no, people were not allowed to do their own little pamphlets on the thing. You know, the government controlled the printing press, and they'd kill you.
In fact, it was against the law to be literate if you weren't a Catholic priest.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
For quite some
time.
So
they control, you know, so we look at these potentially liberating technologies and we say, oh, well, look, you know, the elites end up controlling them. So now we have the internet and people really have gained the capability of the printing press era. We can write, you know, we can publish, but we can't program. We don't program the environments in which this happens. So you can, you know, write on Facebook till the cows come home. And all you're really doing is enabling algorithms that are looking to modify and control your behavior.
Yeah. This is remarkable stuff. Do you see the internet right now as it's been reshaped as a malicious force or as a neutral force or as a positive force?
Right now, it's primarily being used as a manipulative force, right? There's a multi-trillion dollar industry looking at how to control human behavior through our devices. Every time you swipe on your smartphone, it gets smarter about you and you get dumber about it. And if you want to get smarter about it, you're going to open it up and find all of these black box proprietary algorithms that you're not even allowed to know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, and when you learn what they're doing, you find out, oh, Facebook is taking my past behavior in order to put me in a statistical bucket.
And predict my future.
And predict or modify my future.
We're hitting a break. Welcome.
I want to say that chickpea tinga taco.
Yeah, that's, I would eat that. For our commercial stations, I was just doing a live read for HelloFresh.com/Tom. So it's a great organization.
I like just like that phrase, chickpea tinga taco.
Yeah, and we're pleased to have companies that sponsor our program. It keeps us in business.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking.
I can't imagine.
We're talking with
new podcasters. I mean, we're just begging our listeners to give us $2 a month.
Yeah.
But that's
a model too.
It works.
We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff. His new book is Team Human. And we were just talking during the break about how these things are not altogether new. And a hyper-simplified version, you know, if you look at European history for the last millennia, right, there was this long, long period of basically feudalism. And then the Black Death came along, the bubonic plague, killed off a third of Europe. That created such a labor shortage that wages went up. Middle class emerged, essentially, as a consequence of this, the first unions in the 1300s, late 1300s. And that produced the Renaissance, right?
Yeah.
People could music, art, literature. Nobody had time for that before because everybody was essentially a slave. And then that faded out after about three generations, and the kings took over again. And then the printing press came along. And some people say that the printing press is what led us right to the Enlightenment, and right to, you know, Rousseau and John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And these were disruptive events. I was going to say disruptive technologies, but the bubonic plague was not a technology. But these were major disruptive events that had historical consequences
right.
that literally are ringing to this day. And I'm wondering, putting it in that kind of a context, in that kind of very large context, in the development of radio in the United in the world in the 1920s, the development of television in the 1950s, the development then of the internet in the 1970s and 80s, what does this mean for us? How do we, as a species, deal with these kinds of disruptive cycles? And are they always, do they always end up just accruing to the benefit of the East India companies of the world?
Yeah, I mean, if we don't realize what the disruption could do, then they end up not being disruptions. They end up, you know, the digital revolution is a reactionary movement by Wall Street against the potential for wider distribution of wealth that the internet promises. In the early 90s, we used to think of the internet as unleashing the new possibilities for the collective human imagination. Right. And by the time Wired magazine came out and said, no, the internet is the salvation of the NASDAQ stock exchange, that this is an investment opportunity. So we really pivoted the entire internet from connecting people to extracting value from people. We used it as an extension or an amplification of the attention economy.
Absolutely amazing. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Dr. Douglas Ruskoff is the author of the Ruskoff.com, the website. The new book is Team Human. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
being
you
with
do.
Us, Douglas. It's great having you in the studio. I do want to toss out another topic that I'm just wondering what you think about. There was a piece in, I don't recall if it was the Washington Post or the New York Times, but I think it was the Post, earlier this week or late last week, suggesting that if you don't respond to an email immediately, that's bad manners. This is the age we live in. If you don't respond to an email quickly, or at least in the same day, that's very bad manners. That's a naked slap in the face, an insult to other people. And for years, I have been slowly but systematically moving more in the direction of going back to the way things were when I was, back when I was a youngster. Which was, you know, you'd write a letter. Sometimes, you know, it would take me 2 or 3 days to write a letter. You know, you write a little bit, you think about it, you write a little bit, you think about it. And then you mail that letter, and it takes a couple of days for the letter to get there. Or somebody sends me a letter, I get the letter, I read it, I think about it. I walk around with it for a day or so. How am I going to, you know, and what about? And then you sit down and you write a response. And it was a much slower process, but I think a much more thoughtful one. I look at my email every day. In fact, several times a day. And I try to respond quickly to things that I think have high levels of immediacy, of urgency associated with them. But there's a difference between what's important and what's urgent. A dear friend of mine sent an email a couple of days ago that is important, but not urgent. It doesn't require an immediate response, but it was about some important issues of things that are going on in his life and my life and our families. And I've been thinking about how I want to respond to it. And I don't believe he'll be offended when he gets a response, probably for me this weekend. I usually catch up on my correspondence on the weekends. Now, part of that is just my schedule. I mean, you know, Louise and I are up in the morning and between 4 and 5 every morning, putting together the show. We do that until 9 a.m. We go on the air at 9. We're on the air until noon. I go home at noon. I have lunch. And then at 12:30, I sit down and I start writing because, you know, I'm trying to produce 2 books a year here. We just finished, actually, Amazon just put up our Second Amendment book, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment, of Guns in the Second Amendment. We're doing this series of books, and I'm hoping it'll end up being 10 books. That one is available for pre-order right now on Amazon. The next one is going to be The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. And I spent 4 hours writing on that one yesterday. The third book is The Hidden History of Voting and Voter Suppression in the United States. And that's the book I was writing on yesterday. And I'm 3 chapters into that. So anyhow, all this by way of saying that, you know, my workday starts at 4 o'clock in the morning or 4:30 in the morning. And typically I stop writing at 6. And then Louise and I watch Rachel Maddow's show. It's become quite informative. And then we go to bed at 7. And there's not a lot of time in there to deal with email and phone calls and all kinds of other stuff because I've got all these commitments. And that's my workday. And I'm not saying that by way of excuse. I know that we're all busy in our own unique ways. And even if I wasn't busy like that, I think I would still be inclined to sit on an email for a day or two if I thought it was a really meaningful one, and particularly a long one from a friend. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on these protocols. Now, this doesn't just apply to email. I know somebody who gets very, very upset if he calls and I don't call back quickly or if I don't take the call, particularly if he knows that I could take the call. And I almost always take calls from anybody I recognize. If my phone recognizes the name, I always answer it, almost always. And sometimes I'm in the middle of something, like, if, you know, I'm just in this really juicy paragraph and I've got to get this thing down. And I just hope they'll leave a voicemail and tell me, was this urgent? Was it important? Was it neither? Was it both? And then I'll call them back. But, you know, with phone calls, it seems like there's a higher level of urgency. And by the way, if I don't recognize the number, I never answer because there's so many spam calls. And then sort of in between the urgency of phone calls and the slow, gentle process of letters. I have a friend in Washington, D.C., Roger, who literally does not do email. And he mails me letters. And I mail letters back to him. I have a friend in Los Angeles that we kind of send things and letters and books back and forth to each other. And I love it. I mean, you know, it's like, and it's slow. And sometimes it'll take, not a month, but actually, I think in one case, it actually did take a month for one of us to respond to the other in an email. And then in between that, you got text messages and social media and, you know, some everything from Facebook to instant messages to text messages and things like that. So what are your practices? Susie in Vaughan, Washington. Hey, Susie, what's on your mind?
I wanted to weigh in on that email thing. Over 10 years ago, my husband and I both lost our jobs at the same time. And so we were doing our finances and I said, what can we live without? Well, first to go was TV, second to go was internet. We just didn't care. Got what we need on our phones. People can call us or text us. If you're important, I'm not that important. You know what I mean? If you want to find me, I'm not hard to find. And I found you, which is weird because we have radio. So it's, I love it. We love it that way. We're anonymous as much as you can be in this day and age. It feels good.
Yeah. Well, and thanks for listening on KBCS. So is it bad manners, in your opinion, to wait a few days before you respond to an email? Is there a social obligation to respond immediately?
Okay. I have over 5,000 emails is what I'm saying. I don't
Yikes.
Do it. I won't do it.
Oh.
Because every once in a while I go just for laughs to see, you know, what's accumulated. And that's why I'm saying everybody knows my phone number. Everybody knows how to get hold of me. If they want me and it's important, I will respond. But
if you want to talk to Susie, send her a letter or give her a call. Or drop
yeah,
by and knock on the door.
Fun.
Yeah. Okay.
No pop-ins.
No pop-ins. Okay. Don't go over and knock on the door. Yeah. That. Okay. And that's something that, you know, that was the for our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation. That was the big debate. Was, you know, do you make an appointment to visit somebody? Do you leave a calling card? How do you work that out? I mean, in the days even before telephones and things, it's interesting how social mores change as a consequence of technology. It's just fascinating. Susie, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to KBCS.
Yeah, my tax lady said we're like in the wit sex. She said that you did it to yourself, and I said, that's right.
Yeah, there you go. Susie, thank you very much. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.